Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable! Mayweather makes a pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's fact, I'm the best, you know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome to episode 188 of the Last Round Podcast. And as you can tell, no Danny Z opening up the show today. It'll be me and Kevin Ioli from Yahoo Sports. Thanks for joining me, Kevin.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it, brother.
Let's dive straight into it. So Saturday, the 6th of August, Dickies Arena, Fort Worth on DAZN. Virgil Ortiz moves to 19-0 with a TKO 9 over Michael Mickinson, who dropped to 22-1. What did you think of Virgil's performance, Kevin?
You know, not spectacular, but I wouldn't criticize him for it. Like, I think it's one of those in-between performances where, you know, this is a guy that he should handle. You know, I think maybe when we're evaluating him at that top level, you know, the Jerron Ennis level up, you know, he maybe drops a little bit in your eyes. When you're comparing him to those kind of fighters. But I thought, you know, he acquitted himself well. I mean, Mickinson, a pretty solid professional fighter. I don't think Mickinson really ever had a chance to win that fight. But I think, you know, it was a fight that it could make Virgil struggle a little bit. And, you know, so he came through and he, you know, he did what he had to do. He finished him in the 9th round. And I thought, you know, all being said, you know, he looked good overall. You know, not spectacular, but solid enough. And you're going to have fights like that in your career.
Where do you think Virgil goes next because of the promotional issues?
Yeah, that's the craziest thing, right? You know, the division is kind of tied up waiting to see what happens with Spence and Crawford. And so we're sitting there, you know, do these guys fight? Because if not, all of a sudden, you know, Virgil might become an opponent for one of them. Like if all of a sudden we get an announcement saying, well, you know what, they didn't meet my money wish or demand, or this has happened and that's happened, and so that fight's not going to happen. Now, all of a sudden, Ortiz becomes a potential opponent for either of those guys, you know, if Golden Boy would want to go there, and a lot of different things start happening. So I think until that domino falls, we're not going to necessarily really know, you know, what comes next. I've said it a million times. You know, I think you and I talked about this before when Danny was on with us. I mentioned I like the idea of a Jerron Ennis fight with him now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why not? Because, you know, here's the thing. I think boxing promoters say, well, we don't want to ruin it by doing it too early. You know, they're good fighters. They're talented. You can do them multiple times. You know, that doesn't matter. And I think you look at the two guys like that, and that's going to be one that would increase both of their profiles, because imagine the coverage a fight like that would get.
I know that Golden Boy are one of the promotions that do match their fighters hard. Do you think there's a chance, because PBC won't share their toys, that we could see Ortiz Jr. against maybe Alexis Rocha?
I mean, I think certainly that would be a guy that you could, you know, see, you know, pull in there too. You know, I mean, Rocha, I didn't think his fight was all that great though last time out, right? You know, was that a couple weeks ago that he fought, you know, solid again, but not, I thought that was a fight that he should have ended a lot earlier than he did, going as long as he did. But, you know, I think that's a fight that would be reasonable to make. You know, I mean, the PBC's, unless they have everything in their favor, it's difficult to do fights unless they're really big fights, right? And so I think, you know, for Virgil, that's what he's in a tough spot, right? Where he's sitting right now. And, you know, you have Top Rank has a couple guys in there. I mean, you know, there's just not a natural opponent that you say, this is the guy Virgil should fight next.
Before the fight, there was a little video on Twitter doing the rounds where he kind of gone into a little spat with Ryan O'Hara that used to be with the Ring magazine, you know, has been, you know, a prominent journalist. What do you think of something like that? I know the fighters are there and obviously like people are going to give their opinions. Do you think they need to just kind of take that with like a grain of salt and just carry on doing what they do? Because especially someone like yourself, you're paid to give an opinion.
Yeah, I'm a columnist. And so that's what I do. You know, a lot of people don't understand that. They don't understand the distinction. I did not happen to see what happened between him and Ryan. So I know Ryan's a young guy that's, you know, getting his career started. And I don't believe he is a columnist, right? So I don't know. So I don't really, it's hard for me to comment because I don't know what happened. But I think the best thing for these athletes is just to be chill usually. You know, it never helps them to really, you know, go after journalists. And not because journalists are some sacred cows, right? Hey, we, you know, we deserve, you know, criticism when we make mistakes, just like anybody else. But I think, you know, like what good comes out of it, right? I mean, and, you know, it's almost like you're kicking down, right? You know, especially in the situation that he did. And, you know, I find Virgil to be a low-key, pretty easygoing kid, you know, normally. So I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. To be fair, I actually don't know what was said. I just saw that he wouldn't take a question from him on the pre-fight video Zoom interviews that they did. Also on that card, Blair Cobbs moved to 16-1-1 with unanimous decision over Maurice Hooker, who dropped to 27-3-3. Hooker was actually down in round one and twice in round two. It shocked me, to be honest, Kevin. I thought Maurice Hooker, if he had anything left, would have got past Blair Cobbs. I know we kind of talked beforehand and you didn't see it, but did the result surprise you?
No, because I think Hooker's pretty much at the end of the line, right? You saw the weight issue, you know, pop up. And I think that Maurice, you know, he's a guy now, if he continues to fight, is going to be a name, you know, a former champion, a guy who had a couple, you know, good performances, that fighters who are trying to make a name for themselves, they want on their resume, right? You know, I don't like the way sometimes boxing match makes. I think the way that Floyd Mayweather and Oscar De La Hoya were match made was the way to do it, because what happened with the two of those guys, Michael, is Bruce Trampler picked opponents for styles. And he said, okay, when Floyd is fighting at a championship level, who are the fighters he's going to fight? So they looked to find fighters that had similar styles. So when he got in there with them, that he then had, you know, been exposed to that, and he wasn't surprised by anything. And I think a lot of matchmaking today is, I just want to get names on a record. And names on a record don't really do the fighter good. The reason that you're matching people is so they learn something in the ring. And, you know, I don't know that Blair, you know, took it to the next level by beating Hooker. And I think Hooker, you know, is a guy that, you know, his best days are past him.
Moving on to the SSE Arena, Belfast on ESPN Plus. Michael Conlan moved to 17-1 with the unanimous 10-round decision over Miguel Mariaga, who dropped to 30-6. You kind of just explained it, to be honest with you. This was kind of one where it was a name on a record for Michael Conlan. I think going in there for myself, I thought, you know, Mariaga's been in there with a few names, and it looked like it was just going to be a name on a record, and it pretty much was. What's your... Yeah.
I think a little different in this case, though. They undermatched him a little bit because of the brutal nature of his knockout in the previous fight, right? You know, getting knocked out of the ring, and, you know, and that was an amazing fight, right? And then he's coming back, and I'm not sure they knew what they had. I think they wanted to say, okay, let's get him in there with a veteran who's on the downside now, and just see how he reacts, right? And I think he reacted appropriately. I think, you know, he looked like a featherweight contender. He looks like a guy that, you know, is he ever going to be the best guy in the featherweight division? Probably not. But I think he's going to be a guy that'll win some big fights, who will, you know, give the really good guys tough fights. And he'll be a fun guy, you know, and you need guys like that. You know, he's going to be a tough out no matter who he fights. You know, he's going to give it his all. He's going to get a passionate fan base coming. And those guys are important in the division.
Moving on to the fight previews. Saturday, the 13th of August, from the Resorts World Las Vegas on ESPN. Will you be going, Kevin? Or will you be coming?
I will. I'll be there on Saturday. I don't know why I'm going to a fight where we got a 30-1 favorite, but I am going, yeah.
How did you decide? Because you've got Teofimo Lopez, and then over in California, my side, we've got Chito Vera, Dominic Cruz. How do you decide which one to attend?
Well, that was an easy one because it was Las Vegas, right? So I'm here, so I don't have to sleep in a hotel. So I can stay here and watch that. So that's the easy way to go. And I also think Teofimo is a fascinating character, right? I mean, this isn't a compelling matchup, right? Anybody who's tuning in to see, you know, a great fight, I think, is not going to get what they expect. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of drama surrounding Teofimo Lopez for a long time, but really in, you know, 2021 and the first part of 2022. And, you know, you want to see how he reacts to this and, you know, how he handles his first career loss, all the drama in his life. You know, I had a story that's up on Yahoo Sports today about, you know, some of the drama in his life. His wife left him. He's in a custody battle. You know, he's had some other mental health issues. And, you know, the good thing is, and, you know, I talked to Omar Figueroa, who's fighting next week. I talked to him yesterday about some of his mental, you know, he was diagnosed bipolar, ADHD, and some of this other stuff. And you're seeing fighters now come forward and talking about that. And I think, you know, we're all predisposed to mental health issues, right? The pressure that we all face in our daily lives. But then the fighters themselves, you know, it's a tough spotlight to be in, right? You know, I mean, you're fighting in front of, you know, theoretically millions of fans around the world. And, you know, every little flaw you have is exposed and dissected and everything. And, you know, that gets to be tough. And a lot of these fighters are talking about it now. I thought Omar Figueroa, and I'll have a story on him next week, his conversation with me, he was fantastic in what he had to say. Teofimo, I'm not so sure. Like, I wasn't sure that I loved all his answers. I have a video interview up on Yahoo as well. If you read my story, it's embedded atop that. And I kind of, you know, I'm not sure he's really confronted everything he needs to confront.
It's a part of that comment. I don't think it was in your interview, but where he said about him being delusional.
About who being delusional?
Himself, because he kind of touched on, he touched on an interview that I saw where about, you know, we said a lot of things, you know, the media and fans said a lot of things about him. And he's like, yeah, I believe it. You know, I believe I'm the best. I believe I won that fight. And if you guys think I'm delusional, then that's fine.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, Teofimo's always had a lot of confidence, right? I saw him in the, I called him the Honduran idol on the interview yesterday. And he had come up to me at the Olympics. I was in Rio in 2016. And I watched his fight because I saw he was from the U.S., right? And I wasn't familiar with him as an amateur. And then I'm just looking at the rosters, and there was a lot of Americans that were on other countries rosters that didn't make the U.S. Olympic team. And I happened to see him, so I went and watched his fight, and he won. He lost that fight, and he came up to me afterwards, and I have no idea how, but he recognized me, and he asked me what I thought of his fight. And then he said, "You're gonna be writing about me someday, I promise you." And so he's always had that bravado and that confidence and about him. And you know, give him credit, he's mostly pulled it off, right? You know, he's 25 years old, he's been the undisputed, you know, world champion, a lot of good wins, you know, he's had a lot of spectacular wins. You know, I think that he hasn't had the most stable situation, right? You know, he doesn't have a taskmaster as a trainer like, you know, Eddie Futch would have been, or an Emmanuel Stewart, or, you know, Freddie Roach, you know, somebody like that. And his dad, you know, is a knowledgeable boxing guy, but not one that's necessarily, you know, going to make sure, get his son, whip him into shape and make sure that he doesn't. And if you remember when Teo knocked down Kambosos in their last fight, what did they do in between the minute rest period? Teo sitting on the stool, and Teo, actually the father is Junior, so it's hard to say this, but you know, his father was turning to the crowd and, you know, chanting and yelling to the crowd, get up, and not giving instructions, you know. And so that's, I think, you know, he's got a lot to, you know, on his plate to deal with.
So Teofimo returned 16-1 against Pedro Camper, 34-1-1 for his return. A good fight for his return, you think, Kevin, just to kind of get him back in the win column?
Yes, but I wish they would have done a little better with the opponent, right? Now, I don't think a lot of people know a lot about Campa, and that might, you know, be, you know, because you look at his record and he hasn't fought many recognizable names, many ranked guys. So sometimes guys like that will step up and surprise you. But I think that, you know, he's kind of like in a situation like Conlon was in, right? I mean, you know, he had, you know, Conlon was a more physical situation. Teo's more of a mental situation. But I think they just kind of, you know, have to baby him a little bit and find out, okay, is he ready to go? Because if you, throw him in there with one of the top guys. You know, let's just say for the sake of argument, they put him in with Josh Taylor going in this time. I don't know that he mentally would have been able to handle that. But if you get him a win, you get him used to the routine again, you know, used to the, you know, the bright lights and everything, then maybe, you know, he reacts better. But, you know, this is his first fight after his wife left him. He's in a custody battle for his child. He's had other mental health issues that have affected him. You know, he's coming off of a loss. He had that health issue with his chest, you know, where one of the doctors, and he said it in the interview with me, he said, they were talking to me, there was all these trauma surgeons circling me, and they were talking about opening me up and doing a surgery right then and there. And he says, one of the doctors said it was 50-50 whether you survived. So, you know, he was in a bad spot. So I think, you know, matching him easy, I'm usually a very harsh critic of matchmakers and matching too easy. But I think, again, you know, this is the second one that I would say, okay, I give a pass for because of a, you know, extraneous circumstance.
If all goes to plan, your Teofimo Lopez comes back, gets the win against Pedro Campa. Realistically, I know Ryan Garcia and Oscar keep talking about attending this fight and, you know, trying to, you know, talk Teofimo Lopez into facing them next. How realistic do you think that is?
Very unrealistic. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a lot easier fight. Garcia Lopez, to me, is a 10 times easier fight to make than Garcia Davis, just because you take the PBC angle out of it. And, you know, Leonard Ellaby, like, you know, I've called him 4 or 5 times to talk about Tank Davis. Will not take the call because he doesn't want to talk about it, because he knows I'm not going to take the bullshit that he'll try to put out. And whenever you do hear him talk, you know, you see the thing is, you know that a guy's not serious about making it a fight when he first starts. Well, we all know all roads lead through Tank Davis. If you're serious about making a fight, you say, hey, you know what? This is a fight we like, and you don't negotiate in the public. But the first thing he does whenever Tank Davis is, you know, coming up with a big name fighter is do that. You know, he kind of sets it up. Okay, Tank is the guy. Whether that's true or not, we can debate. And I think Tank is a popular fighter, although I do think, you know, some of the tickets, you know, there's something that they can do with tickets. And I'm sure you know this, but maybe the public and people who are watching this don't. If the promoter buys a ticket and just pays the tax on it, they don't have to pay the face value of the ticket. They just pay the tax. It's considered a sold ticket. So they can go out there and they can buy a lot of tickets, and you're trying to create an illusion that a guy's a huge draw. And all of a sudden, you know, hey, he's selling all these tickets, but what was the gate? Mm-hmm. And now, like, you're seeing more and more states refuse to release the gate. And people say to me all the time, why do you always release the gate? Well, it's important because it gives you a sense of, you know, in MMA, they do release the gates in MMA, the UFC does. But it's not as important because one person isn't responsible for the gate. But usually in boxing, the A side is largely responsible for the gate. And more and more states are now not releasing it. And so it's hard to track, okay, is it true what they're saying? Or is it just, you know, hey, are they paying the tax and trying to bump up ticket sales? And I think that's something very interesting. So a Garcia Lopez fight, I don't think is going to happen anytime soon either. But I think it's more realistic than a Garcia Davis fight.
If you were going to matchmake Teofimo Lopez after this fight, someone like a Pedraza, someone in-house at Top Rank, would that be an acceptable opponent?
You know, I think Pedraza may be a little bit low and long in the tooth on the totem pole for, you know, what I would like to see. I mean, you know, Teo wants Josh Taylor. I don't know that you deserve a championship shot off of beating Pedro Campa, right? You know, but I think that that might be a fight, you know, if he gets past Catterall. And that's, hey, I thought Catterall won there, that first fight between them. But if Josh gets past him, you know, maybe that's a fight to go. I mentioned in my interview with him Regis Prograe, because if Regis wins the belt, and he's got the WBC belt. Teofimo was a longtime WBC champion. That might be a fight. And I think that would be a hell of a fight, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be Lopez and Prograe would be a spectacular fight.
No, it would. I think they're both kind of characters. They both do really well. I was kind of just a little bit upset with Prograe, but, you know, he went into that fight with Josh Taylor, really sold himself to, you know, the American fans and the UK fans. But then he kind of did that Amir Khan thing where he was kind of sitting and waiting for like the Adrian Broner fight. Like Khan sat and wasted a long time waiting for Pacquiao and Mayweather.
I think one of the problems that Prograis had is promoters, right? You know, when you know he was with the Bella, and just as he was starting to pull up, he leaves the Bella, and now like he's never had that really big, powerful promoter pushing his cause. And so I think, you know, he fell through the cracks. And like now you're with Pro Bellum, and there's a lot of people don't want to do business with Pro Bellum. I mean, and look at all the stuff going on with, you know, Tyson Fury can't come to the US, and Ben Davidson couldn't get into Australia to train Devin Haney, and you know, all those people that were any affiliation with Kinahan, you know, aren't able to travel, you know, and get in specifically to the US, but to some other countries as well. You know, and now you sign with Pro Bellum, that's going to create further add, you know, to that kind of problem. So I think Regis, you know, was it a bad decision by him and his manager, or was it just circumstance? But I, you know, like normally I would say, hey, signing with Richard Schaefer is a pretty good deal, but signing with Pro Bellum is maybe not the best deal. So, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out.
Moving on to the news and notes, someone you just touched on. Tyson Fury was in the media the last couple of days. Says he's coming out of retirement for a trilogy with Derek Chisora and now has Isaac Lowe as his coach or trainer. What do you think of this, Kevin? Real, not real?
I do, you know, I do think he wants to fight. Like, I took him at face value because he said it so many times that he was going to retire. And, you know, in the ring afterwards, he was adamant. You know, he had said it before, and, you know, and people around him. But then, you know, when he did that interview a couple weeks ago with Frank Warren, where, you know, if you pay me $500 million, then, you know, that showed me that, hey, he's missing it and he wants to get back. And now, what did I make of yesterday's announcement? I thought the first thing he was doing was like he was trying to bump up Isaac Lowe, right? Isaac is a featherweight fighter, certainly not a great fighter by any stretch of the imagination, but a longtime friend of Tyson's. And I think Tyson knows if he does fight Derek Chisora, it's not like he's going to need the greatest trainer in the world to prepare him for the fight. And I think he's trying to do a favor for a friend. You know what? Isaac probably wants to become a trainer when his career is over. He's setting up his friend. You know what? Hey, he trained the heavyweight champion of the world. He was, you know, got Tyson Fury ready to knock out Derek Chisora. And I think that's what he was doing, kind of building up the chops of Isaac Lowe. As far as fighting, you know, I mean, I mentioned it in my story. He said, I want to make history by being the first heavyweight champion to have two trilogies. And I was like, well, Riddick Bowe and Evander Holyfield fought three times in three amazing fights. And then you had Holyfield fought John Ruiz and, you know, admittedly god-awful fights, but they, you know, Holyfield had six title fights against two guys that, you know, and he did it. So that whole thing about the trilogy was nonsense. But I think it was, you know what, he doesn't like Derek Chisora. Derek Chisora is pretty much at the end of the line. Tyson would beat him no matter what, but now I think he really punishes him, right, where Chisora is. So, you know, he get a little kick out of that. He make a big payday. He helps his friend, and it keeps him alive if there's a chance to fight AJ Usyk winner.
You had many one-to-one interviews or interactions with Tyson?
Yeah, of course, many. Yeah.
What is he like to you? Because I've seen in some interviews, he could be quite open, quite jovial than other ones. He's kind of very short, doesn't really give you much time, kind of like answers, kind of like you're wasting your time.
Yeah, you know, I mostly good. Like I've had all the interviews I've had mostly have all been really good, really compelling, really thoughtful or funny. But I had one, like I was doing a one-on-one with him right before he fought Tom Schwartz. And I was trying to ask him a question. And I mentioned Deontay Wilder in the first part of it. What I was trying to set up was, hey, you know, I know Wilder's the big fight that you're pointing to, but is it important to stay busy fighting fights like this? And as soon as I said the Deontay Wilder, those two words, I'd never had an issue with him, always had great interviews. As soon as I said those two words, he goes, I said it, no one talking about Wilder, interview over. And he turned his back on me and started talking to somebody else. And so he's one of those guys like that, you know, he'll do that to you, right? So if you ask him good questions and you're thoughtful and you listen to what he say and you follow up, he's going to give you great, great stuff. But the minute you get to a topic where he, you know, and he shuts you right down and doesn't even, like, he didn't even allow me to try to explain what I, or rephrase the question, right? And And so he, but I, you know, I like him and I think he's a fascinating character and really good for the sport.
When you go into an interview with somebody like that and you already know in the back of your mind, like, okay, I'm going to have to kind of maybe ask some different questions to kind of keep them motivated, because I'm sure, you know, during fight week, a lot of fighters, you know, how was camp?
Right.
You know, what are you expecting? They're getting the same questions over and over again. So do you, is that something that you do for someone like Tyson where, you know, he'll kind of just shut down?
I always try to do that with everybody. Now, it's not always possible, right? Because, you know, I do so many interviews with so many guys, right? That it's not always possible. Like, and maybe you don't know a lot about these guys and there's not a lot out there on a certain guy. And so you, a lot of times, you know, you hope that I can ask maybe one good question that'll open it up and lead to other stuff and follow up. And you really have to pay attention to what they're saying. And, you know, you have to be prepared. And, you know, if I ever ask a fighter, you know, as a serious question, how was camp, I hope somebody comes over and kicks me in the face, because like that is the absolute worst question, you know, that you ever want to, you know, ask them. I mean, that's like, what do you get out of that? You know, you're not going to get a truthful answer, because there's nobody ever, you know, or I shouldn't say nobody because it has happened, but rarely do they ever say, yeah, man, my camp was awful. Like they say, oh, it was great. And I was knocking everybody out. And, you know, and then they, as soon as you ask that question, they look at you as like, okay, he's just one of them and you don't have anything, you know, but if you can ask them questions that make them think that they weren't expecting, then you tend to get, you know, better answers out of them. And Tyson's, you know, was always good like that. And, you know, certainly when he talked about his mental health, that was a story he wanted to tell. And if you would ask him insightful questions about that, boom, you know, he really would open up and give you, you know, amazing stuff. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon the us in the media to realize, you know, we want to show who these they are as people, not just say, hey, what do you think of your opponent? How was your training camp? Who do you want to fight after this? Right. I mean, those are the three questions that they get 800 times in a camp, and you're not going to get really get good answers to it.
Is there anybody now in your career, because I'm sure you've interviewed like hundreds and thousands of people, like you just touched on, is there anybody now in boxing and in MMA that you would like to interview that you actually haven't yet?
That I haven't interviewed? Yeah. Oh, well, I guess one I would say I want to interview is Deontay Wilder, because all of a sudden he doesn't talk to me anymore. And I had great interviews with Wilder, and I thought I was an advocate for Wilder for a long time. And after the second Fury fight, he did interviews with about five or six American boxing journalists on the Monday after the fight. And I was the first one. And I actually released a bit of the conversation because I had so many Wilder fans accusing me of making it up. And I wasn't sure, like, I shouldn't have a reputation of making things up, because I've been around a long time and never has that been ever accused of me that I made stuff up. And so, but what he, you know, I said, the first question I asked him, I said, Deontay, like, what happened against Tyson? Because that wasn't you. That wasn't the Deontay Wilder I've known for 40 some fights. And he said, Kevin, you know, my costume was too heavy. And at first, I wasn't sure if it was a joke. And I go, okay. Like, and I really didn't know how to, you know, and Tim Smith of the PBC actually was the one that connected the call. He was on, and he said that I told the truth and quoted him accurately. And evidence of that was the follow, the people who interviewed him after me quoted the same thing, and they weren't on the same call, right? I think next was Lance Pugmire, who was then at the LA at the Athletic. Then it was Dan Rafio, Keith Idek talked to him, all these guys, and we all had the same quotes, right? But somebody in his camp then told him I was out to get him, and I always wrote bad about him. And so for the third Fury fight, he wouldn't talk to me. And I was shocked, you know, and like I had never done anything. And I always liked Deontay and felt like he was like I remember talking to him. I did an interview with him. We talked about civil rights and how, you know, he felt as a black man in the South, you know, he was, even though he was, you know, a champion and well-known and rich, that he was, you know, looked upon differently. And he talked about when he was in a jewelry store and security guards would follow him around because it was a black man in a jewelry store. And I was really sympathetic to his, you know, his case and everything. And now all of a sudden I find myself on the outs with him. So like, who I would want to interview would be him. I can't think of anybody that I haven't talked to that's of any consequence in boxing. I can't think of any fighter that I'd say, yeah, no, I haven't talked to.
How about in the MMA world? Is there anybody in there that you'd like to speak to that you haven't?
Not really. I mean, I think, again, same thing. You know, I've been doing it a long enough time, and I've been fortunate to pretty much have, you know, everybody from the top on down. And so I don't face that, you know, that's not my issue, right? You know, I have my own issues that I got to deal with, but that's not one of them. You know, I'm pretty much, I know, unless something happens, like, you know, that happened with Wilder, I would love to sit down with him and say, what did I do to you that makes you feel this way? Because I think if he actually, you know, goes through, I will tell a story. John Jones didn't talk to me for 4 years, maybe. And John Jones used to call me when he was on his way up and want to meet me. Like, one day I met him at the Fashion Show Mall in Las Vegas, and I sat in the food court with him, and we talked. And I mean, because he called me up and he said, I want to be interviewed by you. I'm like, about what? He goes, I just want to be interviewed by you. So I met him at the food court and we talked, and I had a really good relationship with him. And then all of a sudden it was like, boom, he's not talking to me. I'm like, what is going on here? And his manager talked to him and couldn't convince him of it. Lorenzo Fertitta, who owned the UFC at the time, couldn't talk him into it. Dana White couldn't talk him into it. And so I wrote a lot of stuff about John Jones for years, and he never talked to me, but I didn't let it come up because I didn't bash him because he wasn't talking to me. That's not professional, right? You know, you shouldn't do that. So anyways, it turned out I was in Toronto and I had just gotten off the plane. I was at the airport. His fight, I think it was the Vitor Belfort. It was either Vitor Belfort or Alexander Gustafsson, but one of those two fights, they were in Toronto. And it was cold. I remember it was in the winter. So whichever one of those two was in the winter. And I got a call from the UFC PR person, and she said to me at the time, I found the story and I figured out what happened. So somebody who used to write for USA Today had written something John didn't like, and John thought it was me. I had nothing to do with it, never, you know, and he thought it was me. And they finally showed him the story and they showed him the quote, and it was by somebody else and it wasn't me. And then he resumed talking to me. So it's like sometimes that happens where you get fighters, like, for whatever reason, they won't talk to you. You know, sometimes guys, you pick against them and they get mad. It's nothing personal. It's like, who do I think is going to win, right? I'm just trying to tell you, I if you watch any of my videos or where I'm talking about fights, I never say somebody sucks, right? Never, ever, ever, ever. I might say Michael was better than Kevin, but I'm never going to say, you know, I might say Kevin sucks, but I would never say Michael sucks, right? You know, and I just wouldn't do that, right? But they get angry because you pick against them. And if that's the way it is, you know, you just got to say, hey, you know, that's life and deal with it. And hopefully they come around, and usually they do.
Now, that's what me and Danny said. I remember when we first had yourself on, and, you know, me and Danny said afterwards, we were like, oh, we liked the way that you didn't like sit on the fence, because, you know, there are media members that we've had on, and you know, they kind of go round the bout and they don't kind of give you like an answer. They'll just kind of talk about the fight, but they won't really ever pick. They'll kind of sit on the fence. I think, you know, because of the fact they don't want, you know, somebody to hear it and, you know, maybe not give them interviews and stuff like that, because, you know, that does affect your career. So I understand it. I understand it.
You know, I feel like, hey, so my job, number one, is to the public, right? And my job are the people who are reading Yahoo Sports. So I owe it to them to give my honest opinion, use my knowledge and my experience to provide them the best look into what is going on. And I mean no ill will toward anybody. And I think most people get that. But you have some that are sensitive and they, you know, they don't like it, and, you know, and they're going to show you. And I said, great. You know, hey, if me picking against you motivates you, then you got a pretty good life, because you don't have much bad in your life, right? And so I've always been like, you know what, I am going to be fair. And if I make a mistake, I will, and I'll say it right to their face. You know, you're right. You make a good point. I was wrong. And I'll tell you one other story that this kind of was, it wasn't a mistake, but Chad Dawson was getting ready to fight. And I don't know who the opponent was, but I was going to write a column critical of Chad Dawson. And I called Kerry Davis up when Kerry was at HBO. And I called him like a day before, and we played phone tag. So now I'm running up on deadline and I need Kerry for my story. And I'm not hearing from him. So I finally left him a message. I said, my deadline to talk to you is X. And if I don't hear from you by X, I'm going to have to go without you. And I told him what I was going to write, that I was going to be critical of Chad Dawson. So he finally calls me about 3 minutes before my deadline. And he says, I think you're looking at this the wrong way. Let me convince you of why you're wrong. And I listened to him. And as soon as he got done talking, I said, Kerry, I agree with you. I was wrong. And so I was going to write a column saying A, and I ended up writing a column saying Z. I went completely the opposite way because he convinced me that I was wrong. And to me, like, that's what everybody should be willing to do. You know, don't change just because somebody else disagrees with you. But if they make a logical point and they prove to you that they are correct, then you should adopt that point, you know, because you always want to get the best information possible and present it as fairly and accurately as possible. Now, we can interpret it however we want, right? And I guess the point that I was making, Michael, was that, you know, don't ever let somebody, if you're a journalist, don't ever let somebody intimidate you out of your position if you believe you're right. But always be open and listen and learning new facts and learning new information. And if you do, then you change your position, you know, because of that, because I think that's the only way that you get widespread respect. You're never going to get 100%, right? That never happens. But if you go out there and people know, the big players know, and the fighters can trust that you're going to quote them accurately, you're going to be fair with how you characterize things, and that you're open, if you go into it with an opinion, hey, I think this is the biggest thing in the fight, and they say, no, I think this is. If you're willing to change that after they convince you and they show you intelligently otherwise, I think you have to do it. And that's kind of what I did in that Chad Dawson story with Kerry Davis. You know, I had this point of view that I was going to take about him. And then after I talked to Kerry, I said, you know, Kerry's right. And I sat there and I thought about it. And I said, I have to redo my whole thought process here. And I changed it the other way.
One thing I've always wondered about is how do some of the bigger journalists like yourself approach asking those difficult questions without, because like you said, you want to do your readers justice. You want to do everybody that, you know, fans of the sport justice and ask difficult questions. For example, like I say, like a John Jones steroids question or like a Conor McGregor, some of the incidents he's had with the law. Like, how do you ask those without, you know, maybe getting banned? Because there are, you know, people say the UFC do control their media.
The UFC, like, I've never had an issue with UFC in terms of what I've asked, what I've said, anything else. Never. You know, they've never said to me, you can't ask this or you can't ask that, or you must ask this or you must ask that. Never has happened, not one time. And over, you know, however long, you know, Dana White and his group have had the company, it never has happened. And I think the way, you know, that you kind of get through it is, you know, you the way you ask the question is like, you know, you try to ask them in a manner, you know, I'm looking for information. I'm not putting you on the hot seat. Now, you know, maybe as they're, you know, as they're answering a question, you have to say, wait a minute. You said this before. Now you said this, right? And you call them on an inconsistency in their story. That's different, but you don't, you know, I think sometimes people, they become, you know, unnecessarily aggressive with them, you know, everybody maybe watched Mike Wallace when he was on 60 Minutes and think that, you know, you got to browbeat somebody. And the key is not browbeating them and showing how tough you are. The key is getting the correct information. And I think, you know, most people will answer the questions, you know, hey, when Conor McGregor got arrested, he knew, you know, he messed up. Now he's going to maybe try to spin it his way. But he'll answer the questions because he knows, you know, that he messed up, and he's going to want to try to use the interview as an opportunity to spin. And I'm going to try to use it, you know, an opportunity to see what he's really thinking.
Moving on, Chris Eubank Jr. against Conor Benn is official for October 8th in London at a catch weight, supposedly 156 pounds. What do you think of this fight, Kevin? And does this have any appeal in the US?
I just can't see it having much appeal at all, right? I mean, guys from two different weight classes and pretty significant differences. You know, Eubank has fought 60 and 68, but I mean, and Ben's a welterweight. I mean, I just don't see it, right? I just don't see where the interest is now. Obviously, in the UK, this is a big fight because I've seen all over social media. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's fired up about it. And I guess there's some personal element. You know, I know their dads fought and, you know, the whole nine yards. There's something going on that maybe I'm missing. But just as a person who loves boxing, I look at it and I go, yeah, it's just a fight, you know, and I don't like to see guys fight that far out of their weight class, right? I don't mind moving around once in a while. You know, back in the day when I grew up, you know, you did see guys take non-title fights and whatever. And you know, they would do that. But that, you know, this was like a big jump for Conor, right? And so what does it prove? You know, if Eubank beats him, like, what is it? How is that good for Eubank that you beat a welterweight? Right, you're a guy that's fought George Groves and whoever, I can't even think who else, but he fought guys at 168. Now you're going to tell me, oh, it's a big deal because I beat a 147 pounder. You know, I don't believe it is.
Do you think it's harder for Conor to go up or Chris to come down because he's fought as high as 168?
Yeah, I think it's hard for, you know, for Eubank to go down, right? I mean, I think it's just the way it is. You know, once you get to that size, you know, guys, they can't do it anymore, you know, and they can't cut that weight. And the older you get, the harder it is generally to cut. So I get why, you know, why they're doing it, but I don't understand the nature of the fight. Like, I guess if I understood the core appeal of it, which apparently exists in the UK, because as I said, I have looked over Twitter today and other forms of social media, Facebook and Instagram, and I see people talking about it, excited about it, and, you know, debating who's going to win already. Obviously, that fight is hitting a nerve among fans in the UK. But I look at it, and I don't think it's like a hugely, you know, significant fight, right? I think, you know, Conor Benn has potential to maybe be a player, a serious player in the welterweight division. I think Eubank is just a guy, right? You know, I mean, maybe slightly more than just a guy, right? I don't think Eubank is ever going to, you know, be anything tremendously special. And what is he, 32 or 33 years old now, you know? And so he is what he is. I don't get it. You know, I just don't get it.
Chris Cyborg shared on Instagram that she'll be fighting De Silva at 154 pounds in a main event of a card on September 25th in Cyborg's hometown of, you might have to help me with this,
Curitiba.
There you go. A warm-up fight before something bigger, like an exhibition against Katie Taylor, something like that. Do you think, Kevin?
Well, she, you know, there was another thing came out today that Kayla Harrison is calling Cyborg out for a fight between PFL and Bellator fighters. And PFL saying they're ready to handle all the money and they'll get it all, you know. So that should be a really, really big fight. I don't know. Again, like, what is Chris trying to prove here, right, in doing this? You know, she wanted to box her whole life, you know. We'll see. I mean, I don't think it's at this stage of her life. Like, I give Clarissa Shields credit, right? Clarissa Shields is a world champion on the rise who has big fights ahead of her, as evidenced by this Savannah Marshall fight. And she went to MMA. I mean, God bless you. You know, you're trying to prove you're the best in the world, period. MMA, boxing, whatever. You're really going out there. Now, she's right now not that great of an MMA fighter. You know, time will show whether she ever can get it and become a good MMA fighter. But God bless her for trying. But at Chris's age, right, she's not going to become a full-time boxer. And to me, it seems like grandstanding, frankly. You know, she's a big, strong, physical woman, but I think sometimes emotionally she's not always as big and strong as she looks physically, right? And I think, you know, she needs to be told she's loved and she needs to be told she's great and all that. And I think this is a way for her to, you know, get some adulation, you know, hey, try something different and all that. I just don't see much in the way of the fight that interests me.
You think it's just kind of, she's going to that Floyd Mayweather realm, coming towards the end, taking some big boxing fights in front of her home fans. And I think there was a couple of years ago when there was talk of her fighting Cecilia Breakers that,
right,
you can probably correct me, that she's won titles in obviously MMA. Is it Muay Thai or kickboxing?
And then I think she didn't win in kickboxing, but she fought in kickboxing. But, you know, kickboxing is an element of MMA. Boxing is really not, right? Because, I mean, people say, oh, he has good boxing. But, you know, you in MMA, you have to defend so many things, right? That if you took a boxing stance in an MMA fight, they kick your legs right out from under you. You know, you would either be injured right away, couldn't walk, or they take you down immediately. And so, you know, when they refer to boxing, it's a lot of times it's kickboxing that they're referring to, right? Which is, as you know, a lot different than actual boxing. And so, you know, these the reason I hate those, you know, Jake Paul fights against, you know, MMA fighters or Mayweather fights against MMA fighters is because what do they prove, right? I mean, we're putting on guys from different sports. And I've used this example with a lot of people, and maybe I've used it with you, but, you know, I compare it to softball and baseball. And before an MLB All-Star game many years ago, I think it was Albert Pujols, A-Rod, and I believe Todd Helton, who was with the Rockies at the time, three of the best hitters in Major League Baseball. They went and Jenny Finch, who was an Olympic fast-pitch softball pitcher, pitched to them, and she struck all three of them out. And the thing, you know, was people are making a big deal about it. They're different sports, and the pitches are coming from different angles, and it's closer. And, you know, so it's like they're cousins, they're similar, but they're not exactly the same. And the same thing is true of boxing and MMA. And so I would say if Floyd fought Connor in a boxing match, and I said, you know, Floyd would knock him out in 8, he knocked him out in 10. If they fought in an MMA fight, Connor would have stopped him in the first round, right? Does that mean that Connor's a better boxer than Floyd because he stopped him in the first round of an MMA fight? Or does it mean that Floyd is a, you know, better MMA fighter than Connor because he stopped him in the 10th round of a boxing match? No. So they're just not the same. And it's not, you know, there's no equivalency there.
Since you brought it up, it's not on my notes, but I know a week or 2 weeks ago, they spoke about Mayweather-McGregor too. Any news on that?
No truth. So I knew it wasn't true just because I know, you know, sort of behind the scenes what's going on both sides. But I talked to people at UFC they all laughed. They said, no chance of that happening. So, I mean, I, you know, just like last time, you know, Floyd and Connor started talking to each other and giving each other shit on the internet, and that, it kind of built from there. But I just don't see that ever happening. So I think that not going to happen.
Someone we spoke about earlier in the interview, former heavyweight title holder Deontay Wilder and Robert Hellenius are in the process of finalizing a deal for PBC on Fox pay-per-view, October the 15th, Brooklyn's Barclays Center. This came from ESPN.
I like that fight. You know, I think, you know, Deontay, we'll have to see what he has left to give, right? I mean, you know, he was in really three. I mean, rough fights with Fury, but especially the last two. And Deontay's been around a while, right? I still think Deontay, I think he beat, you know, I don't know if he beats Usyk, and of course I don't think he beats Fury, but I think he beats AJ, right? I do believe he beats AJ if they fight. And hey, he has the kind of power, as he showed in, you know, all three of those fights with Tyson Fury, that he could beat Fury. As much as I think Fury's style is equipped to beat Deontay's style, hey, you know, all you need is like in that one more second in that first fight and Fury was knocked out. You know, maybe two more seconds in the fourth round of the third fight and Fury was knocked out, right? I mean, so, you know, he's not that far away from getting it. So he's near the top. You know, like if Joshua wins and they can make a Wilder Joshua fight, I think Deontay, you know, has a good shot at regaining the heavyweight title. If Usyk wins, I think that's a tough fight. You know, I didn't have to think about that long and hard because, you know, Usyk is a lot smaller. I mean, it's funny to say a man that's 6'3", 220 pounds is a small man, you know, but fighting at, you know, the Furies and Joshuas and Wilders of the world, you know, you look small at that size. You know, Usyk, you know, hey, Joshua got knocked, I mean, excuse me, Fury got knocked down repeatedly by him. Would Usyk be able to stay away for 12 rounds? You know, that's curious. But I think it's you know, I think he has something going for him. So I think the Hellenius fight is a good fight to kind of, you know, dip your toe back in the water, see where you are and, you know, see what you think. Do you want to do this? Do you feel like you can get back? And so I don't have any problem with that fight.
Not this weekend, but next weekend. And since we have you right now, Usyk Joshua, what did you think of that fight? And what did you think of AJ taking Robert Garcia as his trainer?
So I, you know, before their first fight, I said, and I might have written this, but I know I said it on a video that I did. I said, if I had not seen Alexander Usyk fight Chaz Witherspoon, I would pick Usyk 100 times out of 100 to beat Anthony Joshua. But I did see that Witherspoon fight, and I thought Usyk looked terrible. And I thought really that the size that Witherspoon had presented him problems. So I thought, eh, he's not going to be able to beat a more athletic, more in his prime Anthony Joshua. Of course, I was wrong on that. You know, and he boxed him superbly, had a great game plan. So I go into this fight and I really like Usyk in the fight again. Now, I think, you know, Garcia is an aggressive trainer. What was the mistake that we would say, you know, Joshua made in the first fight? Kind of laid back and he wasn't that aggressive, right? So in that sense, you know, I think Garcia will get him to fight, you know, a little bit more. If he was going to change trainers, I would have liked to seen somebody like Stephen Bredman Edwards, you know, I think would have been a good fit for him, because I think Bred, you know, has that, you know, that combo style that, you know, he would have had AJ box and use some of those. He does have boxing skills, right, that he showed in the second Ruiz fight, but also mix it with aggression, right? I think, you know, he needed that kind of trainer. Derek James might have been another guy that I think would have been a good trainer for him. Whereas, you know, Robert's style, I think is one that, you know, maybe Usyk will be able to pick apart.
It's funny because everyone just keeps talking about, you know, he needs to do this, he just needs to get aggressive. And you think Usyk's not been beaten yet. And I'm sure a lot of people have said, like, just get aggressive, just back him up, just do this, just do that. But, you know, he's managed to found the key to every fight so far that he's really been in. And his amateur career was obviously.
And he's fought great guys. Yeah. I mean, you look, he's the undisputed cruiserweight champion. Look at who he beat to get that. You know, he beat Klowacki, Bredis, Gassiev, Marco Huck. And then he defends against Tony Ballou. Then he moves up to heavyweight and he wins the title by beating AJ. He's an Olympic gold medalist. Like, you know, hey, this dude is good. If he was from, you know, Utah and not Ukraine, you know, he'd be massive right now. But, you know, and he's got a great personality. Like, and if you see him, like, you know, even though his English is non-existent or very small, you know, you see him when he's on TV and, you know, with his facial gestures and everything, you know, he's a funny guy. And, you know, he has good comedic timing. And I think he would be a huge star in the U.S. if he was an English speaker, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, hey, if he beats AJ again, I think it's going to get a lot of attention around the world. And going into a fight then with Fury, I think he would be really big. But, yeah, I mean, I think that you make a good point, Michael, because I think they're underselling Usyk when they say all he has to do is get more aggressive. Well, you know what? Usyk is a pretty smart guy, and Usyk is not like some, you know, just walkover, you know, guy that's just showing up. You know, it's not like he was a 42-1 underdog that, you know, you happen to, you know, have a bad night against. I mean, this is a legitimate world-class, you know, he is, you could make an argument that he's a top 3 pound for pound. I think I have him 5th or 6th, but you can make the argument he's top 2-3 pound for pound. I mean, that's how good this guy is.
If he beats AJ, which I think he will personally, you think we'll see the Tyson Fury fight? And if we do, that could be a stinker because they're both very elusive.
Yeah, I think we will see the Fury fight if he beats him. I don't know that I agree with that it would be a stinker, though, because I think it would be a fascinating chess match, right? Mm-hmm. What do they try to do? I think Fury is going to look at it, you know, and like he said in that second fight against Wilder, you know, I have to go forward. I have to impose my will on him. And I have to remind him he's in there fighting a 6'9", 270-pound guy with an 84-inch reach, right? And that there's no place to hide in that ring. And, you know, Usyk, you know, we're obviously getting way ahead of ourselves here, but Usyk, I think, would have a really tough time. of fighting the style he would need to fight for 12 full rounds. You know, he might get off to a good start against Tyson and be elusive, as you said. But at some point, I think, you know, you've got to look at it and say, you know, that's going to be hard to keep that up. And there's a mental pressure that comes with fighting. You're not only fighting somebody who can knock your head off, you know, or who can box your socks off, but also he can knock your head off, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas when he's fighting AJ, he knows AJ can knock his head off, but AJ doesn't have the kind of boxing skills that would worry him. AJ is a good boxer for a big, strong puncher, but he's not really a good boxer, right? But Tyson Fury is a good boxer, and he's awkward, and he doesn't throw from conventional angles, and you know he has that weird way he moves and everything, and I think it's and he can hit. I think that would be a fascinating fight. I would love to see it.
No, the same. Hopefully we get it, because obviously then we get the Undisputed at last. You know, so hopefully Fury doesn't retire or go down a different path and fight Derek Chisora and stuff like that. So yeah, hopefully we get to see it. But thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you giving me an hour of your night. I know you're going to go for some lunch now, so go for some dinner. Sorry. If you want to just tell everybody where they can find you on Yahoo, sure, and all your social media handles.
Well, I am on Twitter. I am at Kevin I, KEVINI. I'm Kevin Ioli on Instagram and Facebook, KEVINIOLE, all one word. And of course, on Yahoo Sports, if you click on any story with my name on it, you'll get an archive of all my stuff.
And we are at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And join us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round 12.